Welcome back to the Resilient Futures Podcast.
Welcome back to the Resilient Futures Podcast, part of the Institute for Resilient Infrastructure Systems at the University of Georgia. I'm Todd Bridges, and I'm joined by my host, Dr. Alicia Helmrich. Hello, Alicia.
Hi, Todd.
We're excited about the conversation we're going to have in this episode about resilience in the context of national security, in particular, the resilience of military installations. In round numbers, the U.S. Department of Defense operates 5,000 facilities and installations on more than 25 million acres of land across the United States and around the world. These installations include thousands of buildings and a wide range of infrastructure systems, and they are the place where 3 million people live and work. U.S. military installations are located in cold regions and deserts, along rivers and coastlines, on mountains and islands. They include forests, grasslands, wetlands, and reefs, and much, much more. Our special guest today is the Honorable Rachel Jacobson, the Assistant Secretary of the United States Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. Welcome, Ms. Jacobson.
Oh, thank you so much, Todd and Alicia. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you.
Yeah, it's great to meet you. And we would love for our audience to get to know you some more as well. Could you please tell them about yourself and how you got to the role that you're in here today?
Well, sure. Well, I'm Rachel Jacobson, Assistant Secretary of Army Installations, Energy, and Environment. And I am, by training, an environmental lawyer. I've spent most of my career in the United States Department of Justice in the Environmental Enforcement Section, so I really got to know our environmental legal structure in this country on the federal level. And I then went to a foundation for a little while called the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, where I managed a conservation program. And then I was first the Deputy General Counsel at Department of Interior. And then later I was, for 3.5 years, the Acting Assistant Secretary for Fish and Wildlife and Parks, so overseeing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service. And then I capped off my time in the Obama administration at the Department of Defense as DOD's top environmental lawyer. Then I was in private practice for several years, practicing environment, energy, and natural resources law. And so now I'm back in this capacity as Assistant Secretary, and that's what led me to this place. So I've had a passion about these issues for a very, very long time.
Wow. I mean, obviously you are able to draw from a wide range of experience in this space of the environment and energy and systems. Could you tell us a bit about the scope of your current portfolio in the office and the program's work in support of the Army?
Sure. Well, in many respects, the scope of what I do is exactly as it sounds. It's installations, the entire physical footprint of the installations, energy, what energy we use, consume, produce, manage, and the environment. And the environment is everything from compliance, of course, with the many, many environmental laws and regulations that we are subject to, but it is also how we manage natural resources and species, and actually includes historic preservation. So it's a very, very broad scope. It includes construction, it includes again, natural resource management, which is obviously a very major component. And we have a lot of focus right now on energy, how we use energy, how we become more energy efficient. And climate change is a big part of our portfolio. I oversee the Army's climate change policies, and I'm also the Chief Sustainability Officer for the United States Army.
Mm, big job. As a follow-up, especially in respect to climate change, but of course more broadly than that even, could you describe your vision for resilience? I mean, what does a resilient future look like, you know, from your vantage point in respect to the Army and Army installations?
Well, I'll start by saying that the definition of a resilient installation is in law. Congress actually enacted a definition for resilient installations and has instructed us to maintain resilient installations. At its essence, it's the ability of our installations to withstand disastrous events and to recover from them and to make us stronger to be able to withstand them in the future even better. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what the law requires us to do. And I think it's really important to remind folks of this. We're required to do this by law because a resilient installation means a ready force, a force that is able to train and deploy on a moment's notice. If we don't have a resilient installations, our training is compromised. So it is a national security imperative to maintain resilient installations.
And installations, just like cities, are subject to the same pressures and experiences, whether they're hurricanes or droughts or wildfires, etc.
You bet. And in fact, in the case of Army installations, in many respects, we're like cities because we have, Army has the most buildings of, we have more buildings combined than the Navy and the Air Force. And by some measures, we have the most buildings of any agency in the federal government. So in some respects, the ability to withstand severe weather where there are power outages and damage and destruction to real property is no different than buildings. We also manage over 13 million acres of land. So we also have to make sure our natural resources are resilient and able to withstand effects of climate change, and most especially wildfires potentially, because we have a lot of forested land. So on the one hand, we're like cities. On the other hand, we're like large-scale conservation areas, if you will, that have the same pressures against effects of severe climate.
On this note of climate change, the DoD's Climate Adaptation Plan, which was published in 2021, states that built and natural infrastructure are both necessary for successful mission preparedness and readiness. Can you tell us a bit about what the Army is doing in regards to resilience for the built environment?
Well, we're doing a lot. I'll start by saying that following the DoD climate plan that you mentioned, the Army was the first service to publish our own climate strategy in 2022, and we followed that with an implementation plan. So it's not just a statement of strategy, it's how we're going to do it, who's going to do it, how we're going to fund it, and that implementation plan will change every 5 years. It's important that we make sure that we have state-of-the-art construction and maintenance procedures to keep our buildings in particular resilient against potential climate disasters. If you think about it, recently, in the last several years, there was a severe Hurricane Michael, I believe it was, in 2018, that destroyed Tyndall Air Force Base, destroyed it, leveled it completely. And Tyndall is now building back to a resilient state, and they're already at $5 billion and counting. So the way we see it, an investment in making sure we have resilient infrastructure in the way we construct and manage our buildings is an investment against future expenditures. It's a cost avoidance measure. We hope to soon publish a resilient building policy that will at least require all of our construction to consider what a comparable a construction or renovation would look like using a completely resilient, low-carbon material approach versus a traditional approach, and then see how it costs out over the total life cycle of the building, including all components. And we believe that building to a resilient standard will decrease utility costs, will minimize the need for maintenance, and will keep those buildings standing and functioning for a lot longer, and as well as provide a higher quality of life for their inhabitants. So we are going to do this. It's just a matter of getting our policy up. But we're already considering that. We're going to be building soon on under a pilot project. We're going to build climate resilient, low carbon material barracks building at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and that's going to be a low carbon concrete building this coming year. And then next year we're going to build another barracks building at Joint Base Lewis-McChord out of mass timber, which is another sustainable material, low carbon building construction material. So, and we have a couple of other barracks projects in the works where we're going to have net zero buildings as those barracks projects. So we're going to have a build the data to make the case in the future for why that should be our default standard. And we think that the soldiers living in those new barracks will have a much better quality of life as well.
You mentioned a term of art here. Maybe you could explain a little bit. Net zero building.
Right.
You know, can you maybe describe that for our audience? What's a net zero building?
You know, years ago during the Obama administration, my predecessor established a goal. That was Catherine Hammack, established a goal of having net zero buildings in our meaning, no greenhouse gas emissions. You know, buildings that are completely sustainable, use sustainable materials, conserve energy and water. And don't emit any greenhouse gases. For Army, as I mentioned, we have most buildings than Air Force and Navy combined, and our buildings are our greatest source of greenhouse gas emissions. For the Air Force and Navy, fuel is their greatest source of greenhouse gas emissions. So if, for example, we can figure out a totally green jet fuel or ship fuel, they will have solved a large part of their greenhouse gas emissions. For Army, it's buildings. So again, we're no different than cities in that respect. So the goal is, aspirationally at this point, to construct or renovate buildings so that they are zero emission buildings.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So related to that, do you see the standards for resilience that the Army is adopting as able to influence cities? Since, as you're saying, you're dealing with a lot of buildings, cities are built out of a lot of buildings. Do you ever see these standards kind of move beyond the installation after you guys have adopted them?
I think we're probably borrowing these standards from progressive urban planning. I don't see us necessarily as leading the way, although I'd like to say we'll lead the way within the military departments, among the military departments within DOD. But the General Services Administration is already looking at green building policies, electrification of buildings for the federal government. This is part of President Biden's planning and his executive orders to make sure that the federal government does its part to, among other things, as part of our climate strategy, to promote green buildings. Again, you know, it's the long way between planning and implementation, and, you know, we're a very methodical organization, and pretty much everything we do is dependent on having sufficient congressional appropriations. But we're also, particularly with respect to some of our energy work on our installations to promote microgrids and energy resilience on our installations, using carbon-free energy, much of that we're using third-party financing. So perhaps in the future there will even be some opportunities in the building sector for some third-party financing using energy savings performance contract, utility energy savings contracts, and the like. So even though we, our construction dollars primarily come from Congress, our building management and maintenance, as well as our energy projects, we do that as partnerships and in the hopes of bringing in some private financing.
Interesting. And so I get to ask maybe the second half of this question. So we've been talking about the built environment. So let's talk maybe for a moment about the role of nature,
right,
and natural infrastructure, or nature-based solutions, as they are being called now, in developing military resilience or resilience for military installations. A lot of progress has been made in recent years, and the White House has been leading the way in many respects, publishing recently a roadmap on nature-based solutions for climate progress. So how are you, how's the installation community thinking about and working to help nature help us in the context of military installations?
Well, in several ways. And Todd, I know you were very instrumental in the report that the White House issued through your work at Army Corps of Engineers. And Army Corps of Engineers, of course, along in conjunction with the University of Georgia, has been leading the way on engineering with nature. So I'll just mention a couple things. Going back for 1 minute to our resilient building policy and the way we would build buildings in the future. We would have green roofs on those buildings. We would have natural stormwater management features, rain gardens, and other bioretention features for water recharge. We'd have, we would construct our buildings where to maximize use of lighting. So we would incorporate nature-based features, even in the buildings themselves, to make sure that we are having state-of-the-art design. But also, because we manage so many natural resources and we have such huge land mass, and across habitats, we have forests, streams, lakes, prairies, desert habitat, really across the spectrum. So I'll just mention a couple of examples. Fort Cavazos in Texas, which is one of our largest installations that's formerly Fort Hood, renamed Fort Cavazos, has for many years been using bioswales for stormwater management. So it's a vegetated water capture system that reduces flood risk. It's just that simple, right? Much easier to have natural features absorb stormwater and have efficient recharge function to those natural features than have your buildings and your training areas be inundated by floods, right? Again, so it's a low-cost investment to avoid the cost of what the catastrophic flooding could do. And actually, right here at Fort Stewart in Georgia, there's a pretty impressive borrow pit program. I mean, all of these installations, particularly where there's a lot of training, have to do a lot of sort of construction, not necessarily construction of building structures, but construction of training areas and reconstruction of training areas and grading and regrading. And there's a lot of sort of movement of earth, if you will, in a lot of these areas where we do training. And so the Fort Stewart has a borrow pit program, which it conserves resources. It provides an on-source site of suitable soils for fill material. And there's 76 of these areas, but they also support the forestry. They support range activities, and they're designed in such a way so that they will all eventually become fish ponds. So that's just a couple of examples of how we are going to use kind of nature-based solutions to promote training right now, but with an eye towards conservation and best management practices. So those are just a couple of the ways we're doing this now.
Yeah, given the footprint, as you indicated, of the Army, 13 million acres, I'm just excited about the potential in the Army in the years ahead to leverage the natural, you know, to support the purposes of the Army. I'm quite positive in my outlook on the opportunities in front of the Army in this regard.
So am I. I mean, we have all of this, you know, abundance of natural resources on our basis, which is why, by the way, we're home to some 250 or so endangered species that may not otherwise have a habitat. And because of we prohibit development on our installations. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very proud of our species management. I think that indicates our stewardship and our commitment to making sure that we're using the best science, the best management practices as we manage our natural resources. Off post as well, because we have authorities to be able to protect and conserve off-post areas as long as there's some connection to mission, whether the connection is to prevent encroachment, and that encroachment could be, you know, a parking lot for a Walmart, or it could mean a nefarious actor wants to buy property near an installation. But it can also be used to help our climate resilience efforts. It can be used for mitigation in our species protection or other environmental obligations. If we preserve some off-post habitat, we, you know, might be able to then continue our training with the approval of regulators. So we're also conserving off-post areas and again, with a nexus to military purpose, but still it ends up in a conservation benefit.
Right. When it comes to climate change, neighbors are all in the same boat.
That's right, which is why I'm so glad the University of Georgia is convening this workshop over the next couple of days to talk about how neighbors are going to work together to share really best practices in science and technical expertise to make sure that we're looking at managing for the risks of climate change collectively, because these catastrophes do not know boundaries. Mm-hmm. So we have to do this together.
And that's an amazing transition to our next question.
Okay.
Here at UGA, our Institute for Resilient Infrastructure Systems, a foundational element of that is our commitment to this idea of achieving genuine resilience and knowing that that is a multi-sectoral undertaking. Mm-hmm. We have to work with these various actors that you were just naming. How do you see universities like UGA contributing to this cause more broadly?
Oh, wow, there are so many ways where universities could contribute. And we already have some partnership agreements, and we're going to soon announce more partnership agreements with the University of Georgia to help us manage our resources, to help us, to give us some of the best practices. Because now our resource management isn't just expertise in forestry and the like. It also has to be climate science. And climate science is a whole other a discipline that we may not have enough of within the United States Army. So for us to borrow, if you will, through collaboration, the expertise of scientists at academia, as well as other federal agencies, to really understand climate science, to really predict what is this region going to look like 10, 15, 30, 50 years from now? What are the risks that we need sophisticated modeling to properly understand? We need help there. We need help. And so the partnerships with these cross-disciplinary partnerships in particular with universities to team up and work on this together are absolutely essential. I don't see how we would do this otherwise.
So related to that, achieving resilience through innovation will require us and our organizations to think a little bit differently than maybe how we have in the past, conduct business a little bit differently. And one example, looping it back to nature, as we were talking about just a little bit ago. The environment is about a lot more than just simply compliance, but nature offers these different pathways to resilience. What opportunities or needs do you see with the DoD to think and do business differently, and maybe rooting that in the idea of nature?
Oh, I understand what you're saying. So first of all, I mentioned Congress before, that Congress requires us to maintain resilient installations. Now Congress is requiring all of our installations to have our climate resilience implementation plans that will then feed into our broader management plans for our installations. So we have to incorporate climate into our planning by law, which means we have to think about our natural resource management, not necessarily the way we used to do business for many years, but in a way that, how are we going to preserve all these acres? What's the best practice for fuel management in our forests when there's drought? What's the best management for wetlands conservation in areas where those wetlands are drying up? What are the best management practices, again, for making our installations and training areas more resilient to flooding, because we can't do business as usual anymore. I'll give you an example. Last summer, there was a huge storm with the West Point as the epicenter. And you know, it's a very old installation with beautiful old historic buildings, but we've already sustained a couple $100 million in damage from that flood. So we have to think now, not just rebuilding the way it was before. West Point itself has to think about features to reduce the potential impacts of flooding that weren't there before. Installations such as Fort Johnson in Louisiana, formerly Fort Polk, because of their good management practices, escaped many of the ravages of the wildfires that hit Louisiana last summer. You don't think about Louisiana and wildfires, right? But while the parishes surrounding the installations had to be evacuated, because Fort Johnson has an outstanding environmental program and forest management program, it was able to really mitigate the effects of those fires. We have to think about that across the board. You know, Fort Huachuca in Arizona, you can imagine the stressors in a place like Fort Huachuca in Arizona. But they've been thinking all along for several years now about partnerships with local ranchers and also other federal agencies to preserve groundwater, for example, to improve, again, you know, range management practices. So this is how we have to do business in the future. We can't do business as usual. We cannot do business by just looking inside our fence line. That won't work anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is an exciting period of time. And the amount of creativity that needs to be organized, if you will, in this space. We need to understand the problem better, the challenge better. That's where the climate science relates. But then you have the solution part of this. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you going to do about it? Which involves engineering and ecology and social science. You know, we need to bring these elements together to really create and innovate for these challenges that we face.
Yes, we do. You know, it's interesting because the connection between the risks of climate change and its implications, their implications for national security, have been recognized for a long time, dating back, well, for sure, as early as 1991, where George H.W. Bush, in his national security strategy, recognized climate change as a security threat. So we've started, and plus Congress has instructed the military to at least assess the potential implications on our assets from climate change. So we've been studying and studying and studying for many years. Now we have to do something. Mm-hmm. Now we have to do something. So now is when exactly when we have to bring together this interdisciplinary group to come up with mitigation solutions, come up with adaptation solutions, and act.
I mean, there's clearly a lot at stake to think about it in those terms.
Yes.
So one of our last questions here I'd like to pose to you, and it relates to how we downscale, if you will, resilience from the system level we've just been talking about, I would say, to the personal level. I once heard a senior leader in the Department of Defense ask a question where he was linking upgrades to IT infrastructure on a base to the idea of recruitment. And he asked this question. He says, why would somebody leave a smart city to come to a dumb base? And my version of this question is, why would somebody leave a beautiful city to come to an ugly base? And there's been so much science produced over the last few decades demonstrating the connection between the quality of our environment, both the built, the natural environment, and our personal, physical, and mental health. Mm-hmm. So in thinking about that, how can the Department of Defense and the Army support the resilience of its team members at this personal level in the way in which it invests and designs its installations?
Well, that is a very interesting question. And I would say that in some respects, we have to ask the soldiers to give us the answers to those questions. But I will say this. I think soldiers, especially, you know, the generation that's coming into service, they care about these issues mm-hmm. deeply and personally. And I know this doesn't directly respond to your question, but we did establish at West Point a curriculum called the Sustainable Infrastructure Resilience and Climate Consortium. And this is a multidisciplinary program at West Point that cadets can take advantage of, where they're going to have participation from faculty in the chemistry and life sciences department, civil and mechanical engineering department, and the geography and environmental engineering department, to really understand about climate change and Army's role in climate change. And the way, though, that we've seen the cadets react to this is on a very personal level. And I would say across the board, not necessarily just cadets at West Point, but across the board, every soldier in the Army and civilian can be a part of the solution. And so I think a terrific tagline that I think our marketing people should adopt is, if you care about climate change, join the Army and be part of the solution. Because everything we're talking about here, whether it's making sure you're in your own personal space, you're conserving energy and water, working on those ranges to build these natural infrastructure, stormwater management systems, or studying deeply the effects of climate security in the global context and what that can do for global insecurity if we don't address it, all of that contributes to solutions. Mm-hmm.
Well, what you're seeing at West Point, I think, is very much reflective of what Alicia and I see here. Students, young people are very motivated on this topic, and they do think differently. I think, and we should feel positive about that, too. They do think differently about these issues. And it sounds like Alicia and I have some colleagues up at West Point we need to follow up with on
it
this
does.
Topic.
You know what? That would be fantastic.
Yeah, we will do that.
That would be fantastic. I know they would love it. And they're looking for collaboration, and I think it would be terrific. And, you know, the capstone projects that the cadets have come up with so far, and this is a pretty, you know, this is a nascent program. It's only a couple of years old. Are really brilliant, you know, converting food waste to energy and coming up with very elaborate modeling to look by installation of what's the mix of energy that will get an installation to net to 100% greenhouse gas reduction by certain dates, you know, coming up with some modeling for that on an installation-by-installation basis. They're really thoughtful projects, so I think it would be a terrific collaboration if you could. We'll help you work it out.
Yeah, we will definitely do that.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, thank you for joining us today. This episode was special in that we got to do it in person. So that is great. We typically ask our guests at the end if they would be willing to share a haiku, but I think you have an alternative proposal for us.
I do. Haikus, I would say, are not my strong suit, but rock and roll is. And I know we're in Athens.
Oh, yes.
Home of REM. And so I will say it is the end of the world as we know it. It is. But we have to do something about that. We have to exist in this new world in a new way. We have to think differently. We have to act differently. And we have to make sure that we align with nature so that we can all adapt to the new world. But it is the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah. And thank you for making such a poignant reference to Athens. and also one of my favorite musical groups as well.
Excellent.
It's been fantastic. It's been so good to have you here with us today, Ms. Jacobson. We're looking forward to spending some more time with you. And I know our students are very much looking forward to engaging with you later today.
Well, I'm excited about it. So thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Resilient Futures Podcast is an outreach effort brought to you by the University of Georgia's Institute for Resilient Infrastructure Systems, or IRIS. To learn more, please visit iris.com. resilient-future-podcast. If you have any questions, comments, feedback, or ideas for future episodes, please find us on Twitter at rfuturespod or contact our production manager, Sarah, at sarah.bukleitner@uga.edu. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe and drop a review wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.